We have all heard it at some point. Maybe it was in an old Sunday school class, or I mean, maybe you just saw it printed on one of those really faded motivational posters, like in a dentist's waiting room.
Yeah, right next to the picture of a kitten hanging from a branch.
Exactly. The classic, let your light shine. It's one of those phrases that is just so culturally ubiquitous, so hammered into our, collective consciousness that we almost instantly dismiss it as a like a basic moral platitude.
Right, we don't even really hear it anymore.
No, we don't. You hear it and you just think, all right, be a good person, do a few good deeds, maybe make sure you're visibly nice to the barista.
Right.
But what if we've been reading it entirely wrong this whole time? What if this ancient phrase isn't, a behavioral instruction at all, but is actually a highly sophisticated, coded manual for human consciousness?
I mean, it really forces a complete paradigm shift when you look at it that way. When you strip away all that, the centuries of cultural baggage and moralizing, you realize you aren't looking at simple instruction to just be polite.
Yeah.
You are looking at a very precise schematic for how the human mind operates, and more importantly, how it often traps itself.
And that is our mission for this deep dive. Using a curated stack of sources you've shared with us, we are going to decode this famous parable of the lamp, but we aren't just going to look at it from like one standard angle.
Right, that would be too easy.
Way too easy. We are going to examine it through two wildly different, deeply mystical lenses. First, we'll look at the esoteric Orthodox interpretation drawn from the Gospel of Luke, and second, the Gnostic interpretation from the Gospel of Thomas.
And, I think it is vital to emphasize right at the start that neither of these ancient traditions views this parable as merely a mandate to, like, go out and preach the gospel.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they don't view it as some outward-facing marketing campaign for a specific religion at all. Both traditions actually present this as an internal psychological roadmap for, well, immediate awakening.
Immediate awakening. Wow. Exactly. So our goal today is to really figure out what this light actually is, what is actively suffocating it in your life right now, and how you can practically apply this ancient roadmap to your own, daily routine.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can figure out how to uncover this light, we have to, define the hardware. I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what we are even talking about here.
Yeah, people get hung up on the metaphors.
Right. Like when these texts talk about lighting a lamp, are we talking about a flashlight that you just hold in your hand? Or are you the battery itself? Like, are we trying to possess something external or discover something internal?
It's definitely closer to the battery, but I mean, even that implies a sort of machine-like utility, right?
Fair point.
If you look at Jewish mystical traditions, like Kabbalah and texts like Proverbs, where it says something like, the human spirit is the lamp of the Lord, light is the universal symbol for divine consciousness itself. It represents ultimate truth, the unvarnished soul. In this Orthodox framework, lighting the lamp is not about acquiring a new set of beliefs. It's the exact moment of self-realization.
So it's not a tool you just pick up.
No, not at all. The light is divine consciousness waking up inside of you. It's an internal illumination.
Got it. But what about the other side?
Right, so when we shift to the Gnostic view, specifically looking at parts of the Gospel of Thomas, the concept becomes radically different.
How so?
Well, in Gnosticism, the light is what they call the pneuma, the divine spark. And to grasp why that matters, you have to understand that Gnosticism is built on this very stark cosmic dualism.
Meaning a severe split between two realities, like the spiritual and the physical.
Yes, but it goes way deeper than just flesh versus spirit. They believe the physical material world is a fundamentally flawed illusion.
An illusion.
Yeah. In their theology, our physical universe was actually created by a lesser, ignorant deity known as the Demiurge. The true spiritual realm of light is our actual home, but it's obscured by this completely flawed creation.
Okay, let me stop you right there. Because the concept of a lesser deity building the universe sounds a bit like, I don't know, ancient sci-fi.
It does, yeah.
Can we ground this demiurge character in something a modern listener might recognize?
Sure.
Could we look at the demiurge as, say, our evolutionary biology?
Yeah.
Like the primitive lizard part of our brain that just wants to survive, hoard resources, and, dominate others.
Yeah.
It creates a panic-driven, egocentric reality that we get trapped in.
That is a brilliant way to translate it. Yeah. If the demiurge is the architect of our base survival instincts, then the material world it creates is one of anxiety, scarcity, and competition.
Right, which sounds very familiar.
Doesn't it? And according to the Gnostics, fragments of the eternal divine light that Numa became trapped inside this heavy, dense matter, they got locked inside that survival-driven biological machinery.
Which completely flips the reading of the parable.
It totally does. The text in Thomas explicitly identifies this inner light with your core identity. Mm. It basically says there is light within a person of light, and it shines on the whole world. The profound Gnostic shift here is that the person of light is simply someone who has remembered their divine origin. You aren't holding the light. You are the light.
But wait, if I am this divine battery, if this blazing divine spark is my literal core identity, why is the world so dark? Why am I still stubbing my toe in the dark, spiritually speaking?
That's the big question.
Right. If I have this immense power inside me, there must be something actively blocking it. And when you look at the texts, the authors use incredibly specific, almost bizarre items to describe that blockage.
They do. The imagery for the vessels hiding the lamp is very deliberate.
Yeah. So Luke talks about hiding the lamp in a clay jar or putting it under a bed. And the Gospel of Thomas, it mentions a basket or a hidden place. Now, I just have to offer a little pushback here on the purely practical level.
Go for it.
Putting a burning oil lamp under a wooden bed doesn't just sound counterproductive. It sounds like a massive fire hazard.
It absolutely is a fire hazard. And honestly, that absurdity is your cue to pause. The text is practically screaming at you that this is not a literal story about first century interior decorating.
Right. It's not architectural advice.
Exactly. These are highly specific esoteric symbols. Let's decode the Orthodox symbols first. The clay jar is a direct callback to Genesis, where humanity is formed from the dust of the ground from clay.
Wow, so the clay jar is our physical form.
It's the physical form, yeah. But more specifically, it represents identifying entirely with that physical form and your ego.
Oh, I see.
It's the belief that you are nothing more than your appetites, your fears, your social status, and your physical existence. When you lock your identity into that clay jar, you suffocate your spiritual nature. You literally starve the fire of oxygen.
Okay, that makes perfect sense for the jar. But what about the bed, the big fire hazard?
The bed symbolizes spiritual slumber. It represents unconsciousness and really cognitive laziness.
Cognitive laziness.
Yeah, it's that phenomenon of sleepwalking through your life just because it requires less energy. Think about the mechanics of a habit. Your brain wants to automate things to save power.
Oh, right.
You might have a moment of profound spiritual clarity. You know, you light the lamp. Maintaining that awareness takes actual effort. So you allow yourself to fall right back into the hypnotism of mundane, unconscious routines. You put the light under the bed because going back to sleep is just easier.
I mean, that hits a little too close to home. You have this massive revelation about your life. You feel completely awakened on a Sunday. And then by Tuesday morning, you're back to mindlessly scrolling on your phone and screaming at traffic.
Exactly. The biological machine just takes over again.
Wow.
That's the bed. Now, contrast that with the Gnostic perspective.
Mm.
For them, the basket or the hidden place isn't just a metaphor for bad habits or psychological laziness. It is quite literally the physical human body and the material world itself.
Because matter is the actual prison.
Right. To use a more modern analogy, imagine someone playing a highly immersive virtual reality game, but they've been playing it for so long, they have completely forgotten they are even wearing a headset.
Oh, that's terrifying.
It is. And that is the ultimate tragedy in Gnosticism. Amnesia. The divine spark is trapped, asleep inside the flesh, fully believing the VR simulation is all there is.
So what does setting it on a stand mean to them?
Well, setting the lamp on a stand isn't about behaving better or following rules. It is the fundamental act of gnosis achieving direct experiential knowledge of who you really are and mentally taking off the headset.
Okay, so if the light is suffocated by our ego's laziness in the Orthodox view and literally trapped in the VR amnesia of flesh in the Gnostic view, how do we break it out?
We need a mechanism.
Right, we need the mechanics of disclosure. And both traditions use a very famous line here. Nothing hidden will not be disclosed. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Usually when someone says, nothing hidden will remain hidden, it sounds like a threat. It sounds like your internet browser history or your worst mistakes are about to be broadcast to the entire world.
Yeah, it sounds terrifying.
It's absolutely terrifying. But in these texts, it's actually framed as a profound promise.
It is a promise, though. I will say the mechanics of how that promise is fulfilled work slightly differently in each tradition.
How so?
Well, in the Orthodox view, looking at the Gospel of Luke, this actually explains the very purpose of the mysteries. You have to remember, Jesus frequently taught in parables, which intentionally hid deeper spiritual truths from people who were unready or, you know, whose egos were too defensive to hear them.
Wait, so hiding the truth is actually a feature, not a bug.
Precisely. This reveals that truth is hidden only so that it can be discovered at the right time. To use an agricultural metaphor, these teachings are like seeds. They are purposefully buried in the dark earth of your subconscious. They are disguised as simple stories so they can bypass the ego's defenses, take root, and eventually break through into the open light of your conscious understanding when you actually have the capacity to handle them.
Oh, wow. So the promise is that all illusions eventually dissolve.
The truth demands to be found.
It really does. What about the Gnostics?
The Gnostic guarantee, found in Thomas, focuses on the nature of the illusion itself. The ultimate hidden truth for a Gnostic is that the material world just isn't solid. The text says something like, recognize what is in your sight, and that which is hidden from you will become plain to you.
So, wait, recognize what is in your sight. Are you saying the escape route is just through observation?
Yes. If you look very closely at physical reality, if you truly examine the pixels of the VR simulation, so to speak, you see its impermanence. You see its limitations.
You see through the game.
Exactly. If you observe your own ego closely enough, the illusion breaks, and the hidden spiritual reality naturally reveals itself beneath it. And what's fascinating here is how the text offers an absolute guarantee. It promises the eventual release of all trapped sparks back to the divine source, which they call the Pleroma.
The Pleroma. We should probably define that. Is that like heaven?
Not in the traditional sense, no. Not like a city in the clouds with pearly gates.
Yeah.
The Pleroma roughly translates to the fullness.
The fullness.
Yeah. Think of it as a unified, infinite ocean of consciousness and light. When a spark escapes the material illusion, it doesn't go to a new location. It reintegrates into the whole. It returns to the source code. No spark is lost forever.
I mean, that is incredibly comforting on a cosmic scale, to know that ultimate reality will eventually be revealed, that all the sparks will make it back to the Pleroma.
It is comforting, yeah.
But that still leaves us with a very immediate practical problem. How do we actively participate in this awakening right now? I mean, how does a modern listener actually do this today?
Right, in the real world.
Yeah. The texts say to put the lamp on a stand. What does it practically look like to take the lamp out from under the bed on a random Tuesday morning?
This brings the Orthodox concept of exaltation into focus. The stand.
Okay.
Putting the lamp on a stand means intentionally centering your life around this higher consciousness. It is the active practice of living mindfully, allowing your inner realization to dictate your outward actions rather than just reacting to the demiurge's survival instincts.
But how do we achieve that mindfulness? The brain's default mode network is so powerful, it's so easy to slip back under the bed.
The mechanism to prevent that is detailed in the text, which gives us the alchemy of receptivity. It says, consider carefully how you listen.
How you listen.
Yeah, because spiritual growth is entirely dependent on the quality of your attention.
Mm-hmm.
In the original language, the text isn't just talking about audio waves hitting your eardrum. It's analyzing the internal posture you hold while you're receiving reality.
Let me guess. Most of us are listening defensively. We're listening with the ego.
Exactly. Just think about how you consume information on a daily basis. Listening with the ego means you are constantly scanning for threats. You are searching for ways to argue, looking to defend your preconceived notions, or just validating what you already believe.
Oh, definitely. You read an article just to find the flaw in it so you can post a counterargument.
Right. It's a closed loop. Listening with the spirit, using the inner ear, requires you to drop that armor. It requires stillness, humility, and a genuine willingness to be transformed by what you hear, even if it completely dismantles your current worldview.
It's almost like tuning an old radio dial.
Hmm.
The parable is suggesting that divine truth is constantly broadcasting all around you at all times, but we only receive the exact frequency we are tuned to.
Yes.
If my dial is stuck on the frequency of ego, anxiety, and defense, then anxiety and defense are the only reality I will ever experience.
That is the perfect way to articulate it. You have to actively tune the receiver. If we connect this to the bigger picture, you see that consciousness requires constant maintenance.
Okay, so we know the mechanism. We have to cultivate this open, humble listening. We have to tune the dial. But what happens if we just don't?
Oh.
What if a listener decides, this is all too much work? Cognitive ease is much more comfortable, and they'd rather just leave the lamp under the bed. The texts don't just say, oh, well, better luck next time. There is a very harsh warning here.
Yes, there is. The texts become aggressively uncompromising at this point. They introduce what is known as the law of spiritual momentum.
The famous Matthew effect. It basically says, whoever has will be given more, and whoever does not have, even what they think they have, will be taken from them.
Right.
So what does this all mean? I have to be honest. If you look at this materially, it sounds like spiritual capitalism. The rich get richer, and the poor are punished and violently stripped of what little they have. Yeah. How is that fair? How is that a law of divine consciousness?
I get it. It sounds deeply unfair until you realize it is not about economics or punishment at all. It is a mechanical law of nature. It is the ultimate use it or lose it rule.
Walk me through the mechanics of that.
Yeah.
How do you lose consciousness?
Think of it like neuroplasticity. In the Orthodox view, if you cultivate even a tiny amount of spiritual awareness, if you have a small flickering lamp, but you intentionally choose not to react defensively, putting it on a stand, you strengthen a neural pathway.
Okay, that makes sense.
Your capacity to understand multiplies. Awareness generates more awareness. But if you neglect your inner life, if you hide your light under the clay jar of materialism, that mindfulness muscle literally atrophies.
It just withers away from disuse.
Yes. And pay close attention to the phrasing. Even what they think they have will be taken. Things like your ego, your intellectual pride, your inherited religious dogmas, these are illusions of possession.
Illusions.
Right. You think they are yours, you think they protect you, but when the inner light goes out, those illusions collapse. You realize they were hollow and you were left with nothing.
Wow. I'm assuming the Gnostics take this a step further. If the Orthodox view says your awareness atrophies, does the Gnostic view say you literally lose your divine spark?
Well, the Gnostic text addresses this by focusing on the accumulation of direct experience. Having a spark means the universe will actively yield deeper mysteries to you. Consciousness naturally expands, but whoever has nothing refers to specific states of being.
What do you mean by states of being?
The Gnostics actually categorized people based on this. They talked about the Hylix people who are entirely consumed by material physical existence.
The ones who don't even know the VR headset is on.
Precisely. And then there are the psychics people who rely only on blind faith and intellect, but have no direct spiritual experience.
So they have opinions about the light, but they don't actually have the light.
Exactly. Lacking that active, awakened spark of direct experience, which they call gnosis, their superficial beliefs and their purely physical lives will eventually disintegrate into the darkness of matter. They lose everything because they never possessed the only thing that is actually real.
That's intense.
It is. And this raises an important question for everyone listening to this. Are you actively cultivating your own direct awareness, or are you just resting on inherited dogmas, hoping they will sustain you when the lights go out?
Wow. That is a heavy check on where we put our daily energy.
Yeah.
All right, let's pull all of this together. We have covered a massive amount of ground in this deep dive.
We really have.
We started by looking at this seemingly simple platitude, let your light shine, and realized it's a radical psychological call to wake up. We traveled from the Gnostic vision of understanding ourselves as divine sparks trapped in a biological simulation, all the way to the Orthodox warnings about the mechanics of spiritual sleepwalking and letting our awareness atrophy through disuse.
Yeah.
The overarching lesson here for your actual daily life is that attention and intention are everything.
That is the core synthesis. Whether you view the physical world as a literal Gnostic illusion holding you prisoner, or you view it as an Orthodox psychological training ground for your ego, your daily task remains exactly the same.
You cannot afford to be passive.
Right. You must take your light out from under the bed of laziness and distraction, and you must intentionally place it on the stand of mindful living. You have to tune your internal receiver every single day.
Which brings up a really fascinating modern dilemma to close on. We've spent this whole time talking about ancient vessels that hide the light, right? The clay jars of the ego, the wooden beds of lazy habits.
Yeah.
But if spiritual growth is entirely dependent on the quality of your attention, as we discussed, what happens to a society that entirely outsources its attention to algorithms?
Oh, that's a brilliant question.
As you go about the rest of your day, I want you to mull this over. By constantly handing our focus over to endlessly scrolling feeds engineered to keep us outraged and distracted, are we actively building a digital clay jar? And if the mechanism of the universe is use it or lose it, what happens to the divine spark when the algorithm is the only thing doing the listening?